Thank you, Deborah. That was very gracious of you. Yes. So I'm going to talk about the Orbiting Carbon Observatory 2, a satellite that NASA's first satellite designed to measure carbon dioxide in Earth's atmosphere with the kind of precision needed to actually look for the sources emitting it into the atmosphere and the sinks, those places where it's being reabsorbed. Now, but to make all of that make sense, I'm going to start with a part of the story that is maybe a little bit better as a place to start. I'm going to talk a little bit about something called the global carbon cycle and this process that we're actually trying to study with the satellite. Now, the global carbon cycle, the main piece of it that I'm going to start with is the so-called 300-pound gorilla in the room, which is us. We've recently become a major part of the global carbon cycle on the planet by emitting about 40 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere each year. That's about 5.5 tons for every man, woman, and child on the planet. But as Canadians, like us North, the rest of us North Americans, we tend to overproduce a little bit, and we're sitting up at a little bit more than 10. So in any case, carbon dioxide emissions into the atmosphere have been a major source of concern and interest over the last few years. But it's important to realize that those carbon emissions are superimposed on an incredibly vigorous natural carbon cycle that emits a lot of CO2 into the air by itself and then reabsorbs a lot of it. The oceans are a major player in the global carbon cycle. The oceans actually, first of all, emit about 330 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every year. But then they turn around and reabsorb about 340 billion tons of carbon dioxide. Pretty neat, right? Pretty well balanced, been doing that for a while. The forests are even bigger players in the system. And they actually emit about 440 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the air every year due to respiration primarily. But then through photosynthesis, they reabsorb about 450 billion tons. Add those two numbers together for the emissions, and you basically have the natural biosphere and oceans emitting about 20 times as much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere each year as human activities. But the difference is they're balanced. They reabsorb most of that carbon dioxide. In fact, they absorb more than they emit, such that they're actually absorbing some of the carbon dioxide emitted by human activities. Well, let's look at that story a little bit more as we go into more detail. How do we know how much carbon dioxide is emitted into the atmosphere from these processes around the world? Well, the answer is because we've been making measurements from an increasing number of stations, starting at Mauna Loa, which is right here on this map, notice here, and this is basically the Mauna Loa station shown in red here. This is latitude along this axis, and this is CO2 concentration along this axis, and what we're looking at is a time series that started in 1979 when we had about 335 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and we're watching the reports from all of those stations, and notice that the number of stations is changing over time. It's increasing over time, and what we're seeing is spring, summer, during the spring and the summer, land plants in the northern hemisphere have this incredible spring drawdown where they basically take so much carbon dioxide out of the air, it actually reduces the carbon dioxide concentration significantly in the northern hemisphere. You see the counteracting effect in the southern hemisphere much smaller, largely because there's much less land down there. Okay? So we've been making these measurements, increasingly precise measurements over time, but also you might have noticed that we started down here. Oops, sorry about that. We started way down here in 1979 with this very, very small amount of carbon dioxide, and it's been increasing rather steadily ever since that time. It's increased by, just to put this in perspective, since the beginning of the industrial age in about 1750, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has increased from about 280 parts per million to about today about over 400 parts per million globally. That's a tremendous increase in carbon dioxide, a 40% change in the carbon dioxide abundance of our atmosphere since the beginning of the industrial age. Half of that change has occurred since 1979. That's when I started graduate school. A quarter of that change has happened since 2000. And the rate is increasing. So, this up and down, That's that natural carbon cycle, land, the ocean, and then the land biosphere, breathing away. But this movement up, that's us. Okay? So it's a very interesting system, one we're going to learn a lot more about. Now let's take a look at what we know about this system as we've gone through time. What I'm showing here is just a plot of the, as a function of year, this is 1960 over here and 2010 over there, and then this is the number of tons of carbon dioxide emitted by human activities due to two processes that are illustrated here. The first process is actually fossil fuel emissions. They're shown here, and they go up and up and up and up and up. You might notice that every now and then the fossil fuel emissions have gone down. These are the fuel crises of the 70s, late 70s and early 80s, from Iran and all of that stuff going on. This is the recession of 2008. So you actually see economic activity very clearly in the fossil fuel emissions. But also you might notice that this is 10 billion tons a year, which we were emitting in around 1958. And this is almost 36 billion tons of carbon dioxide. The amount of carbon dioxide that human activities have been emitting into the air every year has been increasing rather spectacularly over the last few years. A lot of this latest change, notice how it kind of comes up here, it kind of levels off, and then we have this big bump at the end. What's this? Any ideas?
China.
Yep. India, some in Indonesia, Brazil, the developing world, but mostly China. Okay, so that's been a big set of changes that we've been seeing over the last few years. Now, down at the bottom here, I'm showing another component which is actually also important here. So that was all due, the stuff you've seen, we've talked about so far, has all been due primarily to fossil fuel emissions, mainly for power and transportation, and also, it turns out, cement manufacture. In addition to that, we also have the CO2 emissions due to land use practices. And this, the main effect of land use practices, of course, it includes things like agriculture and stuff like that, but it also includes slash and burn agriculture in the tropics and deforestation, just generically. And as you can see, that's actually reducing over time. This was basically a very bad time. This was the last major El Nino, and we deforested most of South America during that time, so that was that little peak. But it's been going down generally over time, and we're kind of hoping it keeps that trend. Now, but this is human activities releasing fossil fuels, or releasing CO2 into the atmosphere from biomass, essentially, and this is human activities releasing fossil fuels into the atmosphere due to greenhouse gas emissions. And I already told you that we've been making these really, really detailed measurements of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. These are all done from inventories. In other words, actually counting the number of barrels of crude oil burned, the number of tons of coal burned, and actually the acreage of forest burned, for example. Well, we've been making those atmospheric measurements over time, and we've been watching the buildup of CO2 in the atmosphere. And you would think that if these inventories were accurate, that the sum that the actual amount of CO2 that should have been building up in the atmosphere over time should be kind of the sum of this term and that term. That's what you would expect. That's what it is. That's a little strange. Instead of the amount of carbon dioxide that's been building up in the atmosphere over the years being the sum of these two terms, it looks like the average for some reason, or like half as much. In fact, what's going on is that some process at the surface of the Earth, the oceans, the land biosphere that I already introduced you to, is absorbing over half of the carbon dioxide emitted by human activities. And it's been doing that as long as we have been making measurements. This is a pretty neat little point, and one that's missed by many. If these processes were not operating, the rate of buildup of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere would not be what we've seen. It would be twice what we've seen. These processes are incredibly important. But they're also largely unknown. We know that about a quarter of the CO2 we dump into the atmosphere every year ends up in the oceans. How do we know that? We measure the pH of the oceans. And it's been getting more acidic. We don't know where the CO2 is coming in and going out in detail, but the measurements we have indicate that, you know, as we would expect, cold water absorbs a little more CO2, warm water basically emits a little more. You take your nice beer out of the fridge, you pop the top, it's nice and fizzy, that's CO2. Leave it on the table for an hour or so, what happens? Goes a little flat. CO2 exhales from the liquid, in this case beer, and into the air, and we've added CO2 to the air. Your beer has been a source of CO2. Now, the oceans are warming up. Has anybody heard that from anybody? Should we be concerned about that? Just a question. Land plants actually are fertilized by CO2 a little bit. But in general, CO2 is not ever the limiting nutrient for plants. And if you're a farmer, you know that it is not the most abundant nutrient that keeps a plant from growing. It's the least abundant. Usually it's phosphorus or water. Okay? So CO2 does fertilize plants, but it's not going to save you. But for some reason, as the CO2 emissions have increased over time, the land biosphere and oceans have been absorbing progressively more and more and more CO2. We don't know where on land, where we know more than a quarter of all of the CO2 we emit is going. We don't know where that's going. We don't have a clue. We've been looking, too. Has anybody seen a new rainforest the size of the state of Texas spring into place since, say, 1990? Anybody? We've been looking. We checked the whole planet out from space. We haven't seen it. But somehow, that's about how much carbon we're talking about. I'm not kidding. And we don't know where. We can't even tell you whether it's the northern mid-latitudes where you live, or actually slightly north of that. We don't know if it's the tropics. We're getting some hints. It wasn't the tropics last year. So once again, we're beginning to learn about these things because we have to learn about them, because this effect is one that we are going to be depending on as we go forward and people start thinking about maybe actually figuring out how to manage CO2. So why is it so hard? I'm talking about 10 billion tons of carbon dioxide. Why is that so hard to find in the system? Well, as CO2 is actually added to the atmosphere by sources like this biomass burning here in Africa, in Central America, the east coast of the U.S. here, China, burning fossil fuels, in this simulation, you can see all of those processes going on. Isn't that fascinating? And as the CO2 is actually added to the atmosphere each year, it's evected around, it's transported around by the winds. That makes it a little bit difficult to actually trace the origin of that CO2, especially if you paid close attention to that previous set of the presentation where I showed you that the measurements of carbon dioxide being made from around the world. We make those measurements from now slightly less than 200 stations around the world. This field is fairly complicated, right? How would you sample that field with just 200 stations around the world? Well, unfortunately, this is what you get. Those are those 200 stations. You can see in the background the CO2 going past them. Find the sources. Find the sinks that are absorbing half of all the CO2 we're emitting. This is what we've got to work with. This is what we've had to work with until fairly recently. But one way to actually maybe get past this and make a new contribution is to not make a few hundred measurements of carbon dioxide every week, but to make hundreds of thousands or millions of carbon dioxide measurements around the world every week. And one way to do that, the way we actually did this for weather forecasting, is we put instruments on satellites, we flew them in space, and we took lots and lots of data around the entire planet. Thought this would be a good idea to try that for CO2. But there are a couple of details I didn't mention about that previous map. Maybe it's worth going back to for a sec just to make that point. As we look at these beautiful maps, this is a high-resolution model run by our colleagues at Goddard Space Flight Center, And what we're seeing here, the highest values of CO2 here are actually on this chart, 395 parts per million. This was for 2006, by the way. Things have changed a lot. The lowest values you see here are about 375. So there's about a 2% difference pole to equator on there. The largest differences you're seeing in CO2 over the entire Earth is 2%. That's because CO2 is a long-lived gas, and as you dump it into the atmosphere, it tends to stay there either for less than 1 year or for somewhere between 300 and 1,000 years. It really hangs around. So if the land biosphere and the oceans don't take it out in that first year, you're stuck with it. Okay? That basically, notice here, though, that a lot of the CO2 has disappeared up here. What's happened there? That's the land biosphere waking up for you in the spring drawdown. Okay? That's how dramatic it is. Now, we've had models like this for a while, not at this resolution. There's only a few of these that have been run. But they've been telling us a lot about the system. But we thought we might actually do something revolutionary and go out and take some measurements and see how much of the models, how credible the models really were, and whether or not we could actually inform them a little bit more with actually making some detailed measurements. But that's harder than it seems. It turns out to do that, this is basically what it takes to make measurements of CO2 from space. We use reflected sunlight for this because we could use thermal energy as well, but if you use thermal radiation to measure carbon dioxide, it turns out you need a thermal gradient between the place, the surface and where the CO2 is, and we turn out missing all of the CO2 down near the surface. But with sunlight, as the sun shines through the atmosphere, bounces off the surface and goes back up to the satellite, it bumps into all of these CO2, and it turns out oxygen molecules as well. Okay? This is an interesting possibility. These are CO2 absorption bands in the near infrared. This one's at 1.61 microns. This one's at 2.06 microns. And this is a really weak CO2 band whose absorption goes up kind of linearly with the amount of CO2. And this is a stronger CO2 band that we initially included primarily because it gives us a strong constraint on the vertical distribution of clouds and aerosols. If the light goes from here down to here and back to the spacecraft, we need to know that path length very accurately. How accurately? 1% would be generous. I need to know it to a tenth of a percent. Okay? So if I have clouds up here that are transferring a few tenths of a percent of sunlight back to the spacecraft before it can be observed, or before it goes through this whole path, I need to know that. So it turns out I know how much oxygen there is in the air, very accurately. The oxygen mixing ratio of the atmosphere is 20.0935, I think, so I know it to 5 significant digits, just about everywhere on the planet. And so what I really do is I use the oxygen band to tell me what the optical path length is, or to give me a very good constraint on it. In fact, it tells me where all the aerosols and cloud layers are up there as well. And then I use the CO2 bands to literally count the number of CO2 molecules along that path. But I'm not actually measuring CO2 with my satellite. I'm measuring reflected sunlight. That's the way it works. And then I use something called a remote sensing retrieval algorithm. We'll talk about that in a little bit more in just a second, which basically is just a sophisticated model for generating synthetic spectra, basically synthetic spectra that are supposed to match these spectra, based on an initial guess for what the atmosphere looks like. I convolve that with a model of how the instrument actually processes that spectra. And then I use an inverse method, which is just a fancy nonlinear least squares fitting technique to improve my guess for what the actual atmospheric composition is. And I go around and around and around, and I eventually get values of something I call XCO2, which is the column average CO2 dryer mole fraction, which is kind of an average concentration of CO2 along that path. Is that straightforward? Now, then comes another incredibly important part of this game. This is the most accurate trace gas measurement we have ever attempted from space by a factor of 3 to 5. Does anybody else know what trace gas we actually measure very accurately, like to 1% or better from space? Any idea? You've heard of this gas. Nope, not CFCs. We don't get those to 30%. We're in great shape. Ozone. For the last, actually since the 1980s, we've been making ozone measurements. And since the 1990s, we've been making measurements of ozone that are as precise as 1%. But they have a lot easier job because most of the ozone is up here above the clouds. and that makes it much easier to measure. And there are lots of things about making a measurement all the way down to the surface that makes it complicated. So what we've actually included, in addition to a very sophisticated and very sensitive instrument, which I'll talk about in a moment, is a validation system in order to validate the measurement we make and the retrieved estimate of CO2 that we have from the measurements we make against every other possible standard. We have a number of standards here, including flask. What's a flask? Well, it's literally a glass bottle we open up, we fill it full of air, we close the bottle, ship it, FedEx it to Boulder, Colorado, they analyze them there. The other kinds of ways we have carry flasks and non-dispersive both laser and non-dispersive systems on aircraft. We have a brand new measurement technique here called AirCore, which is really neat. It's just a 200-meter long tube that's all coiled up. Open at one end, closed at the other. We drop it up in the atmosphere, and it has a trace gas in it, a fill gas to start with. The fill gas runs out, leaks out as it goes to high altitudes, up to 30 kilometers altitude. We then cut the cord and let it fall on parachute, and as it falls down through the atmosphere, this long, skinny tube, acting like a capillary tube, slowly fills up with atmospheric gas. We then chase the thing 70 kilometers downstream and hope it didn't fall on somebody's house or hit some cow. And we pick it up in the field, and we read it out with an analyzer, and we get a profile of CO2. Believe it or not, these are producing the best vertical profiles, in situ measurements of CO2 through the stratosphere that we've ever had. We have, of course, tall towers now. Sorry about that. We have instruments on tall towers. And there's actually another technique that I'll introduce that you should all know about right now. We also have ground-based up-looking spectrometers that are designed to look straight at the sun and measure carbon dioxide and other gases. Deborah Wunsch and others have actually put together a number of these stations. They're called the Total Carbon Column Observing Network, TCON. And that's been our principal transfer standard. In fact, we use the TCON station results to produce a transfer standard between what the satellite sees and what we see with flasks on the ground or in aircraft of various kinds. Okay? So, record spectra, retrieve estimates of XCO2, and validate those measurements. Let's see how that works. Recording that spectra is not trivial. We have developed a very, very sensitive instrument for doing this. It's basically a very simple spectrometer. Those of you who took an optics course in second year of physics or something have probably made spectrometers as complicated as this. This is a simple grating instrument. It's a long slit imaging grating spectrometer. It has a common telescope here. We go through some relay optics that bounce the light around and drop it into a narrow slit. It gets expanded into a collimator, hits a plane grating, goes back through a camera telescope, which basically makes a picture of the spectrum that it sees at the focal plane. Okay? The pictures of the spectra that we have, three different channels, as you saw in the original slide, they're identical to the one shown here, just to go back to that. This is the actual spectrometer. Notice it has three channels. They're pretty much identical in configuration. And in those three channels, we get the oxygen A band. As I mentioned, we measure oxygen. Then we have a very weak CO2 band and a very strong CO2 band. This is wavelength along this axis in each of these three cases. This is around 0.765 nanometers. This is 1.61, and this is 2.06 microns. These are two weak CO2 bands two CO2 bands in the near-infrared. So new detectors, all kinds of things had to be developed. But to make this one of the most difficult instruments we've ever built at NASA, you can't really tell by looking at it is this is optically one of the fastest spectrometers ever built, and it's also one of the highest spectral resolution spectrometers that's ever been built using basically first order off of a plain holographic grating. So this has a resolving power of 20,000, roughly, and it has a focal ratio of f1.85. And we managed to do that with four lenses, which is bizarre. I was an astronomer, and I basically limit the number of glass pieces in the system, respect every photon, focus it as well as you can. This was an incredibly difficult instrument to build. The depth of focus is the largest tolerance in the entire instrument. That's basically if I move this part, the detector, forward and back by 25 microns, 1/1000th of an inch, that's my full depth of focus. And I built this to put on a rocket and launch into space. Yes, I had that kind of a reaction from most of the engineers at JPL as well. So But the idea was to take measurements not slowly, but very quickly. Even though I came from an astronomy background and I'm used to integrating everything for 20 minutes to several hours, what we have to do here is the spacecraft is traveling along the Earth at 7 kilometers per second, and I wanted to take measurements at a rapid rate so that even in a region where there were some clouds, I would get some clear scenes. I'd also give some spatial resolution. So we take measurements 3 times a second. Those 3 measurements are actually this is the spatial dimension of the slit. We actually image that, and in this particular frame, which is actually our first light frame, there was a cloud in that footprint. That's why it's brighter. A little bit darker up here because that was topographically dark region. So we get spatial information along this axis. We actually get 8 discrete footprints, and once again, basically 3 × 10^16 speckled channels. Now, the spacecraft actually flies around the Earth once every 100 minutes. So we orbit the Earth 14 and a half times each day. And notice this nice map here. This is a MODIS cloud map. MODIS has a 2,000-kilometer wide swath. And I wish we could measure CO2 over a swath like that. Our swath is actually less than 10 kilometers wide. So that little blue line you see maybe running right through the middle of each one of these nice MODIS swaths, that's the actual low CO2 track. So this is a sampling mission. It's not a mapping mission. This is actually a picture of the swath going across the Strait of Gibraltar, to give you an idea of its actual size. Now, if you look at it really, really hard, and if the projector is nice, I can sort of see it in this one over here. You can see individual little parallelograms. Those are the individual footprints that we record as we're flying along. Each of those footprints includes data in the 3 spectral bands that we have. And so taking data with 8 footprints, 3 times a second, we basically take 24 soundings per second as we fly over the Earth. That gives us about 1 million soundings a day. Now remember, we have about 200 stations on the surface, and that was our data set prior to this. We actually flew another satellite called GOSAT, which gave us an extra 300 to 1,000 measurements a day, typically. This instrument is giving us about 130,000 cloud-free soundings of CO2 over the Earth every day. Okay? So that was the innovation that we were able to bring forward. Now we have to calibrate, and I'll just touch on this. The instrument does include a calibration system. I put this in when I was having trouble with it, that's why. The calibration system is a little paddle. It has a solar diffuser, transmissive diffuser on this side. It has a little mast off reflector on this side that I light up with 3 little lamps. And with that, I can actually determine the radiometric performance of the instrument. And I do that on every orbit. So every 100 minutes, I recheck my radiometric calibration. This transmissive diffuser for the sun, I also look at the sun once every orbit. I see the solar lines in these bands, which are well resolved. And I actually then can check the spectroscopic performance of the system, the instrument line shape, and other aspects of it on every orbit. We have some special calibrations as well, where sometimes I just look at the sun for an entire orbit over the day side. And what I see there is when I'm coming around the south pole of the Earth, I'm moving about 7 kilometers per second toward the sun. When I'm moving along the north pole there, away from the sun, I'm moving about 7 kilometers per second. That actually produces a Doppler shift in the solar lines. That's several pixels across our array. This instrument is high enough spectral resolution, it actually resolves those kinds of Doppler shifts. So as one of my colleagues likes to say, one of the side effects of this instrument is we actually prove a couple of aspects of the theory of relativity on every orbit. In any case, we also look at objects like the moon for geometric calibration and versus fixed stars, and we use measurements on the ground to see whether we're lined up. And it actually turns out in this particular case, this was an early case where we were off by a couple of kilometers in our surface calibration. So we calibrate the instrument, and we're extremely, we calibrate the instrument essentially continuously. Let me see if I can get rid of that thing. Yes. And another way we calibrate it is against observations of well-known, well-characterized surface targets. Turns out there's another satellite up there called the Greenhouse Gases Observing Satellite, which is a Japanese satellite. We've worked very closely with this team. The GOSAT satellite makes a measurement in about a 10-kilometer wide footprint. This is in a place called Railroad Valley, Nevada. It's a very, very well-characterized dry lake bed. We put people down on the surface with ground-based instruments. We fly over. We make measurements with GOSAT. These little black dots in here are OCO2 observations of that same place, taken within about 20 minutes of the time the GOSAT instrument takes them. You can see the size of our footprints relative to the large GOSAT footprint. We take a lot more data than they do. Okay? And so we compare those data and produce high-resolution spectra like this. And even though the instruments actually are more different than these, this excellent agreement indicates, they use a Fourier transform spectrometer, we have a grading instrument, so forth and so on, the spectra are amazingly consistent in their agreement at this point, within a couple of percent, it turns out, in radiometric and spectroscopic calibration. So, what do these spectra look like, and what kind of information can we get from them? Well, first of all, I'm going to give you what I refer to as my 2-minute course on atmospheric radiative transfer and remote sensing retrieval theory. How about that? Everybody ready? On your mark? Get set? Okay. We start with something called a remote sensing retrieval algorithm. That basically is a forward radiative transfer model that basically generates synthetic spectra and Jacobians. Jacobians are the first derivative of the radiances as a function of the optical properties of the atmosphere. So the rate of change of the radiance at this wavelength as a function of the amount of aerosol at 3 kilometers above the surface. Okay? And we have Jacobians for everything like that. Okay? We add to that something that's basically a prior state. This is our guess for what the atmosphere looks like. The model is initialized with that, and it dutifully we actually add a bunch of other information. We have laboratory measured cross sections for gases, aerosols, we have solar spectra, they're getting better and better and better all the time. We add viewing geometry information for the satellite into that, and we generate beautiful high resolution spectra, synthetic spectra. Those spectra then have to be convolved with information about the instrument's actual spectral and spatial resolution properties, and then we generate spectra that look a little bit more like those that are returned by the satellite. We then have an inverse model, which is, like I said, just it's an optimal estimation-based system, so it's basically just a nonlinear least squares fitting tool with a constraint on it. We add some other additional information into that, and this model actually then goes and corrects our initial guess for what the atmosphere looks like to produce a better fit between the observations and the simulation. So we go around that loop many, many times, usually 3 to 5 is about all it takes, and it converges and gives us a solution and generates a retrieved model atmosphere for all those parameters we put into it, and then estimates of the column average CO2. So that's basically how it is. Okay? Straightforward, right? Anybody can do this. We had to revolutionize just about every step of that process to get the kind of accuracies we need for this experiment. Now, let's look at what we're getting, though. We started out with an instrument that was built to be optically very fast. My background was astronomy. If you've ever seen pretty pictures from the first 15 years of the Hubble Space Telescope, that was the wide-field planetary camera. I built the calibration system and every optical surface in that system. Okay, and the spectral filters were all mine. That was my contribution. So I tell people I gave them the colors they saw in those Hubble pictures back in the old days. But in any case, I came into this as an astronomer, and I came into this with the idea that I needed super high signal to noise if I was ever going to hope to actually measure carbon dioxide to the kind of precisions we needed from space. And there were advantages and disadvantages to that, but I actually accomplished the number one thing. The signal noise I'm getting in these channels, you probably can't read these numbers, but the blue here is a signal noise of about 400 per spectral sample, so every single point on that spectrum. The yellows and reds here range from 800 to 1,000 in signal to noise. Now, to put this in perspective, the GOSAT instrument, if I plotted the same things out from them, would be between 3 and about 10 times lower than that. So this is a super high signal noise instrument, even though it's taking data very, very quickly. That's why optically fast was an important thing and why I put my engineers through the process of building an instrument with these kinds of tolerances. What we get from that is our retrievals of XCO2, we get single-sounding random errors that are typically around a half a part per million. That's what the light blues are here for most of the Earth. Up around the most northern and southerly ends of the extremes of the Earth, I kind of run out of sunlight. One of the main reasons I actually made this instrument so sensitive was so that it was also essential that it have a very large dynamic range, because the amount of sunlight available, the brightness and darknesses of the surfaces vary so much from pole to pole on this planet, and I wanted to get as much of the planet as possible. So we accomplished most of what we set out to do. Now let's look at some of the actual measurements. This is what measurements look like from the satellite. What I've done here is I've plotted out the actual measurement tracks of OCO2. I'm putting out about 3 days per second on this. And what we'll see as we move through this, we're starting out in now October of 2014, and we're moving through this. Notice everything's kind of a light blue. That's because it turns out the CO2 abundance has been increasing so fast, we've been running out of range here. But in any case, what you'll see is that there are places, there are clouds along the intertropical convergence zone. As we get into the northern hemisphere winter here, this is already December, there's no sun up here. And I'm having a lot of trouble up here, not just because of low sunlight, it turns out, but because there are a lot of clouds in the wintertime. Has anybody noticed that? This is a royal pain. Can we do something about that? I'm trying to make a trace gas measurement here. In any case, as the winter proceeds, and we're now already getting into to February here, notice how I'm getting some yellows up here. What's going on there? Well, the northern hemisphere biosphere has been asleep now for a couple of months. It's basically been frozen out, and it's not absorbing any of that CO2. But respiration is continuing, and those trees are still emitting stuff into the air, but they're not absorbing it anymore. So guess what? The CO2 is building up. We're also dumping a lot of CO2 in the northern hemisphere because we all live there. So as we go through this, notice how this it's now turning much yellower. Oh, but wait a minute. What's going on here? This is now blue and green. Well, that's because we're already in June, and the plants are starting to pull that CO2 out of the air. We saw that with the movie you saw before, the model that we ran before. But what we have never seen before this is actual global measurements of carbon dioxide showing things like the spring drawdown through the system and the evolution of CO2 through the seasonal cycle. So we've been actually studying these data for now a whole 2 years. We're almost beginning to understand it. I think that's a fair way to say it. The training wheels are still on here. We're still learning how to use this data product, but it is actually a very useful product. Now notice here, this is biomass burning. This is basically slash and burn agriculture in Africa. You can actually see a nice brightening, bright yellow over here. And as we start getting some sunlight into Europe, you'll see some nice bright yellow over that as well. But once again, what we're seeing here is a lot of the features that we expected to see in the CO2 field. Some of our colleagues are trying to make it a little easier for us and using models to assimilate this data, just like we assimilate weather data to produce your weather forecast. And they're producing nice distributions of products like this, which show how the CO2 is actually distributed in the atmosphere. Now, notice that kind of little bit of flickering that you're seeing there? Turns out that's an artifact of this, but it turns out it actually shows you how the model starts out with an initial guess for the CO2, and it's being corrected by the OCO2 observations, and that's that jump you're seeing, okay? So notice it's building up quite high in the northern hemisphere here, but basically this is what would happen if we maybe could see a little bit more of the Earth in those individual little tracks we got from OCO2. This is a balanced CO2 field that matches the OCO2 observations pretty well, not perfectly yet. Okay, so people are working on those kinds of products. Let's look at the next step in this. The next question we have to be asking ourselves is, the largest changes I mentioned that you were seeing there were about 2%, and in fact, most of the changes you were seeing were a couple of tenths of 1% in CO2. These are very subtle changes in CO2. Are they real? You got to be asking that question, right? And so we validate these against a whole host of things. And I mentioned before that our primary validation system is the TCON network. The TCON network started out as a single station here at Park Falls, Wisconsin, and has now grown to an ensemble of, is it 21? Something plus or minus one. And so depending on who's in service today. Around the entire world. The most southerly station is down here in Lauder, New Zealand. The most northerly station, you might notice, belongs to somebody in the room. Is Kim here? Yes. Okay, in any case, we basically span the globe in latitude, and we have pretty decent distribution around the world. This Manaus is no longer in service, unfortunately. That was our only really good tropical rainforest station. In any case, when we fly over these stations with OCO2, we don't always just look down or look off at the glint spot. We actually can target a location on land and actually scan over it as we fly over. And take about, it turns out, nine or so thousand measurements, and about a few thousand of those in the center of that domain are used for validation. So this is looking at Edwards Air Force Base here. No, that's Los Angeles. That's Caltech sitting right about there. And that's Lauder, New Zealand over there, showing a little scan across it. So we have this distribution of stations that spans the world. We make comparisons between the space-based measurements and the ground-based measurements. These are the TCON results. These are the OCO2 results. And guess what? There's not perfect agreement. We're not quite there yet. We're getting closer, but we're still having some disagreement. There are some biases in our data. We understand physically from our knowledge of inherent errors in the algorithm where a lot of those biases come from. When we go and correct those in a sort of ad hoc fashion, things will improve. Things improve substantially, but we're still not dead on yet. And there are some. If we look at these biases over time, the errors right now are on the order of a part per million, and globally they're about 1.5 over the whole Earth. But we found that as we look at a time series of the measurements, there were actually certain times and certain places, certain stations, where we get very poor observations. The errors of several parts per million, up to 3 parts per million here, even though most of the time they're down here at the less than 1 range. By the way, this is Edwards Air Force Base just north of Los Angeles, and this is Los Angeles. These are taken fairly close together, and basically what we're seeing here is about a 5 part per million difference between my polluted hometown and just north of us where we're seeing the background. Megacities emit a lot of CO2, but they're not our biggest sources. In some places, such as over Lamont, Oklahoma, we get, fairly good agreement as we make these overpasses in comparison to TCON. So this is a time series showing from 2014 all the way through, February 2016. We have fairly close correlation between the black dots, which are TCON, and the OCO2 measurements, which are the other symbols. After the bias correction, things correct even better and produce even better agreement. In other places, though, in particular, this little region toward the southern end of the world, near Lauder and Wollongong, Australia, it doesn't look so good. The TCON measurements are running along a kind of a straight line down here, and the OCO2 measurements pop up and come down. And this is actually our biggest single problem with the data set so far. This was identified. The bias correction, by the way, doesn't make it go away. This was identified as probably the major issue with our processing to date. And we've been studying it in detail. We do a bias correction for the whole world. It's just shown here. You'll see it has some spatial coherence. We basically have to adjust the deserts in one direction. Most of the oceans have a low bias, so we bring them high. Deserts have a high bias, we bring them low. Due to some known, like I said, known issues with the algorithm. But then we have this fringe down at the bottom. These are high errors that occur during a specific range of months between about May and August of 2015 in particular, also a little bit in 2016, but not as bad. What's going on there? Well, after a lot of detective work, we also noticed that in addition to a high CO2, we noticed that it was doing weird things with the clouds and aerosols in the retrieval algorithm. We actually retrieved clouds and aerosols in this algorithm as well simultaneously. And it was taking sulfate aerosol from near the surface and casting it up into the atmosphere in these cases where we saw high CO2. And we thought, that's weird. But it seemed to be very, very well spatially correlated and temporally correlated. And we found out what it was. Finally, one of our colleagues, Ken Jux at NASA headquarters, said, guys, do you ever look at stratospheric aerosols? Maybe that's your problem. And so it turns out that was our problem. We had a volcanic eruption, this giant volcano called Calbuco, popped off in April of 2015. It dumped a whole lot of sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere. After a couple of months, it actually turned into sulfuric acid aerosol, and our model was desperately trying to put it up there but wasn't doing it well enough and producing a large error. That's what the error looks like in the current version of the algorithm. We know it was the aerosol because when we put the aerosol in, it gets better. Now, it's not perfect yet. We're still working on that. So what can we learn from all of this? Just some real quick run through some science results. First of all, megacities. As we travel over a megacity like Los Angeles, what we find is red here is high CO2, yellow is lower CO2. We see about a 5 part per million difference in CO2 as we fly across the basin, whether we do it in target mode, targeting Edwards and Caltech or flying across just the standard track, we see systems like Los Angeles. One of our colleagues in Finland just recently published a paper where he took all of the OCO2 data and looked for anomalies over time, persistent high CO2. And he produced these lovely maps for us that show us where the CO2 comes out. Guess what? East coast of the US. Guess what? Northern Europe. Guess what? China. But there's also a lot of CO2 coming out from biomass burning down here. And he correlated this with measurements of nitrogen dioxide from another instrument called OMI on a satellite that's right behind us and flying in formation with us. And he found out that, well, this looks like fossil fuel emissions because we know that fossil fuel emissions generate NO2. That looks like fossil fuel emissions. What in the world's going on here? That doesn't look like fossil fuel emissions. That's actually biomass burning. How do we know that? Biomass burning doesn't produce much NO2. Okay, pretty simple stuff. Look at China, look at Southeast Asia. Look at China, look at Southeast Asia. Biomass burning, fossil fuel emissions. We're learning that from this satellite now, so we're learning stuff. Now, other folks are looking at fires in Africa, and we're finding that, sure enough, in regions where there are large MODIS fire counts, we see high CO2, high CO, and they're well correlated. In regions away from where the higher fire counts are seen, we see very poor correlation between the CO and CO2. Other folks have been asking, what difference did the El Nino make to CO2? And we found a very interesting thing there. As the El Nino was just beginning, we saw the emissions from the tropical ocean drop substantially. As the warm water came in, that capped the vertical transport of water and the vertical transport of CO2 from the deep ocean. And basically, the CO2 fell. But then the land biomass started drying out and heating up, and fires started, and it pumped up the CO2 right after that. Nice little picture. Most of us expected something like that to happen, first time we've ever seen it. Others are doing really detailed, what we call flux inversion experiments, where they take a global circulation model and the CO2 measurements, and they say, what is the flux distribution that is consistent with the observed CO2 distribution? And the actual modeled winds, and they give us fluxes. And what they're finding is northern hemisphere was actually sucking up a lot of CO2 during the El Nino. The tropics were a net source. That may not be a general result, but it was general for last year. We're measuring other things like chlorophyll fluorescence, which tell us something about the rate of photosynthesis. This is Des Moines, Iowa, here. And as the satellite flies across it, the cornfields glow nicely. We can tell how fast plants are sucking up carbon dioxide because this is proportional to their uptake of carbon dioxide. This is giving us additional constraints. We're making global maps of this. I won't go into this in detail. What I wanted to finish with is a real quick look into our future. OCO2 was one step forward. The next steps will take a little time. We had an early satellite called Skiamaki, which made measurements using the same technique that I mentioned, but it didn't have the precision that we have, that we needed. Then GOSAT, the Japanese greenhouse gases satellite, flew in 2009, and it actually finally gave us the precision that we needed, but it only gave us about 300 to 1,000 measurements a day. OCO2 now is doing that with 130,000 measurements a day. We have a methane satellite flying now, it turns out, not until March at the earliest, called Sentinel 5P. It will be making methane measurements using the same technique. The Chinese are flying a satellite at the end of this year called Tansat that will make CO2 measurements. And then GOSAT-2, the follow-on to the Japanese mission, will launch in 2018. Later in 2018, the flight spare instrument from OCO gets installed on the space station as OCO-3. As we go into the future, there are a whole series of additional missions that are still in the planning stage. But once again, as time goes on, we're going to get more and more information like that. What we've tried to do with OCO2 is to actually be a pathfinder that kind of goes forward into the future and gives us some insight. However, what we've recognized and have long recognized is that none of the systems shown here, even those looking into the future to the early 2020s, really provide the kind of data that we need. We need spatial mapping data with much higher resolution coverage that we're getting even with OCO2. So we've got some work to do as we move into the future. So in summary, OCO2 was launched in July of 2014. It's been returning about 1 million measurements a day since September of 2014. It's finished its nominal mission at this point, its prime mission of 2 years. We're going into an extended mission. We have a healthy spacecraft and a healthy instrument. The data has all been archived at the NASA Goddard DAC. You can download it using that URL. Cost you nothing except disk space, lots and lots of disk space. And the carbon cycle science community is trying to figure out what it all means at this point. So with that, I'll stop and take your questions. Thank you very much for your patience. Say that again?
What assumptions are being made about the vertical mixing of CO2? And the second is there any supplementary information from the samples?
Okay. The flux inversion models actually require an estimate of the vertical mixing. And right now, we're using there are probably about three different meteorological models that are used as the basis of our vertical transport. We use the GMAO model. Some groups use the GMAO results as their vertical transport and the horizontal transport. Some use the ECMWF reanalysis as their initial boundary condition for their model. Then we use GEOS-5 to actually do the mixing. So, and we update it. It's regularly updated. Now, it's not perfect, believe me. And we know that this is one of our biggest uncertainties. But these column measurements are less sensitive to our uncertainties in the vertical transport than, say, measurements that are valid only at one level. And the second question was limb measurements. Stratospheric measurements in particular would still be of value. We're getting a lot better stratospheric data than we used to have due to things like air cores being flown regularly around the world now. We had exactly 6 profiles when we started this game. Now we have that went above the tropopause with CO2 measurement instruments on board. So now we have hundreds. But vertical information from limb sounders like ACE and so forth would be very useful if we can get the accuracy high enough. That's the real challenge.
Yeah. One of your earlier slides, you said that there is X amount of anthropogenic CO2 being thrown up, and about half of that is being absorbed by land. And as you correctly pointed out, there are no forests growing up, as we know. So doesn't it simply mean that the existing vegetation is absorbing more, obviously?
It obviously means that acre by acre, some regions are much more productive than they have been in the past. We know some of those regions, but we can't come up with a budget. One of the things that's been very, very much controversial in the last 5 years is a suggestion originally made from GOSAT data, reinforced by OCO2 data, that Eurasia, temperate Eurasia, is actually absorbing about a billion tons more CO2 than we, or a billion tons more carbon, so about 3.7 billion tons of CO2, more than we thought. We can't, for the life of us, figure out what's going on there. There is one thing that has been suggested that I think is probably really close to the truth. During the tail end of the Soviet era, a lot of Eastern Europe was deforested. During the beginning of the post-Soviet era, as these countries were essentially wild, they deforested the whole bloody place. So some of the absorption could be regrowth in Eastern Europe, where we have been seeing regrowth from our satellites. That might explain a pretty good part of that billion tons, but maybe not all of it still. I'm still not convinced.
Yeah, but in general, it suggests that the photosynthetic rate adjusts to the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere.
Yes.
Has anybody from the field of botany and allied?
Yes, absolutely. We have three different groups kind of fighting to get the right answer here from different approaches. We have folks using kind of phenologic methods, basically looking at how plants grow and what they take to grow and where their measurements are telling us. Because in some places like North America and Northern Europe, we have that information acre by acre from essentially departments of agriculture, right? So they've been using that kind of stuff. Then we have other groups that are using space-based measurements where we essentially measure the aerial coverage of greenness. So we use that information, and then we're using atmospheric measurements from the ground, from space, from aircraft, to measure these things as well. So we're trying to bring these three methods together and get an understanding of what's going on.
Can you see gas flares from gas production?
Oh, so I'm not allowed to talk about them, but no. Yeah, especially I have to go home, remember. Okay. Let me do something that tries to be less controversial. Do you see this from where you are in the back of the room? That's an extraction activity around the Persian Gulf. Do we see it? Yeah. Is it in anybody's inventories? No. No, they don't. They don't monitor it. They just burn it. It's based on how much pressure they've got in the back and in the pipe. Not, they don't care.
I was thinking it would be a great big calibration.
Wouldn't it be wonderful? There are some places. No, they. Quite frankly, most of the places that are actually doing flaring are doing it to save a buck. You can't get them to do anything extra for you. And actually, their extraction operations very clearly in places other than that I can point out, where we're seeing significant amounts, and I won't point out any specific places. The two largest sources that we've discovered have been associated with extraction activities. So, and they're not on anybody's inventories.